This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
It states, there has arisen almost by magic this magnificent creation, the Lewis and Clark Exposition.
If you look at the old pictures of the exposition taken in 1905 and look at the same site now, it really does seem like a magical apparition. Let's take a short walking tour. Don't worry, I'll do all the walking. So right now we're in what's known as Industrial Northwest Portland, outside of downtown. It's a little rough around the edges. Where we are at the moment, we see two large warehouses on either side of us and an unused railway track just behind us. Now let's go back 108 years. We are on a small peninsula surrounded by a body of water roughly 2 miles long and 1 mile wide named Gild's Lake. We can see behind us the gigantic Romanesque structure of the U.S. government building. As we keep walking southbound, we step down into a courtyard and through the, quote, sunken gardens. On our right is the U.S. Life-Saving Station, where the Portland River Patrol held dramatic recreations of heroic rescues for crowds on the mainland. Then, at the southernmost tip of the peninsula, we reach what is known as the Bridge of Nations that will take us over the lake. In the present, we are walking past a drum teaching workshop and a stone builder supply warehouse. And it's unfortunately starting to rain pretty good today, so let's go back to 1905. We are reaching the end of the Bridge of Nations. One of the great attractions of the Lewis and Clark Exposition was an elk that was trained to dive from a high point on the peninsula into Gild's Lake below. This seems amazing considering that Gild's Lake in the years before the exposition was viewed more as marshland than as a lake. It was a tributary of runoff from the nearby Willamette River, generally never exceeding 3 feet in depth. But a little elbow grease and a lot of damming turned the marshland into the pastoral scene that we see now as we walk past the lakeshore esplanade and the exotic wonders of the Japanese village to our left. In 2013, however, we pass a lumber mill with its high doors swung open and an out-of-business convenience store on the corner, where we take a left and head up to what is now known as Montgomery Park for the old Montgomery Ward building that it used to face across the street. At the moment, Montgomery Park is much more office buildings, a hospital, and parking lots than it is a park. Back in 1905, this area was the bustling strip of state buildings, where the different states of the West erected monuments to their culture and natural resources. We pass the Washington Building and approach a massive structure with each of its four sides constructed to look like four different famous Spanish mission fronts. The building has a red-tiled roof and large mission doors that look so real, quote, that one would almost wait to see the dark-gowned monks lift the latch and file out slowly past the orange trees. This was the California Building. Inside, the space was incredibly high and open. There were stairs that led up to a balcony which wraps itself 360 degrees around the room. The main room in the center of the building is flanked by four massive pyramids made up of California's natural resources. One pyramid of beet sugar, one of seeds, one of beans, and one of grains. In the center of the room is a surreal and beautiful pyramid of every type of flower in the state of California, preserved in formaldehyde and placed in long, slender glass vials. As we walk across this main room, we pass 12 pillars that support the balcony above us. These pillars are shelved with bottles of wines and olive oils, except for the last four columns toward the end of the room, which are constructed out of hollow glass that have been filled with walnuts and almonds and act as a sort of a throne for the creature at the foot of them, a life-size elephant made out of California walnuts. The walnut elephant is shown with his trunk reared in greeting towards his companion at the other end of the room.
Well, I'm looking at a photograph of...
It seems to be covered in...
It has a bear made out of some type of material.
His arms that are reaching out to you and his...
And you can see some of the display. You can see some jars of probably of fruit or olives or other sorts of product and piles of things in the background.
It's like in some type of exhibit.
Mm-hmm. Mouth is open. Doesn't quite look like a mouth, but I'm sure it is.
On the opposite end of the room, we view a 9-foot-tall grizzly bear standing up on its haunches with its nubby little arms reaching outward. Its roaring mouth and gleaming teeth might make its expression fierce if it weren't for its somewhat dopey, almost cat-like eyes. Also, the bear's entire pelt was constructed out of some 20,000 Sacramento Valley-grown prunes. In an article from 1904, the prune bear was described as having, quote, mechanical eyes, which presumably moved back and forth. And back. And forth. And it had a gramophone, a type of early record player, stuck into its mouth, which sang, spoke, and also presumably... Finally, let's head back to 2013 one last time. The squirrels are scampering around in a slightly waterlogged fashion. You can hear the chatter of two doctors in the distance. We are standing in the upper parking lot of Montgomery Park. Thus concludes our tour of the Lewis and Clark Centennial Exposition. Tips welcomed.
Here, about reserved.
Hello, my name is Andrew Weymouth, and you are listening to 100 Tacks. This episode is on the Great Prune Bear. It seems silly now, but around 100 years ago, people all around the world were first becoming familiar with the state of Oregon via the Oregon prune. People have always dried fruit as a means of preserving food, generally by using the most affordable heat source on the planet, the sun. Simply set your fruit out on your tin roof or on a sheet next to your orchard and let Mother Nature take over. This was the method used in Turkey, Germany, and France to create what was then seen as the typical dried prune. It was small, extremely sweet, and hard as a rock. This prune was so hard that it needed to be soaked in water overnight and stewed in the morning in order to be edible. This quality made the prune an ideal lightweight food ration for the American military during the Spanish-American and First World War, which led to California becoming a major domestic producer. But the California climate was too hot for the larger, meatier varieties of prunes, such as the Fallenberg prune, which was later recognized as the Italian prune, which went on to be celebrated internationally as the Oregon prune. The Oregon prune is a case of nature spurring on innovation. The Oregon climate, although mild enough to harvest the larger varieties of prune, was far too cloudy and rainy to attempt the traditional sun-drying method. Around 1850, the first large-scale indoor dryers were built around central Oregon, and for the first time, it created a product that you could take right out of the box and sink your teeth into. Thousands of prune dryers and subsequent prune-drying facilities sprung up around Oregon and southern Washington. A slew of designs for the new barn-sized indoor dehydrators were patented during this time. Some were dryers where you set the fresh prunes onto trays that go up 30 levels to the very top of a very wide chimney. Some where the prunes were carouseled around on dollies that were set into tracks. And also where the trays were put into very long tunnels, like an oven the size of a three-car garage. These were called tunnel dryers. This is the type of dryer Janet Fisher owns on her family land in Kellogg, Oregon, about 60 miles south of Eugene.
I'm owner of this farm. It's been in my family for almost 150 years.
Out of the hundreds that used to dot the Oregon countryside, hers is the last of around five that are still in operating condition. The structure was built around the turn of the last century and bought and renovated by Janet Fisher's father, Eugene Fisher, in the 1940s.
The Oregon prune is a distinct and peculiar variety, differing decidedly from any other member of the plum family, very agreeable to the palate and of high medicinal virtue.
Alma A. Rogers, a poet and journalist from the turn of the last century, was a voice in the previous episode of 100 Tacks, and coincidentally, she happens to have made a very good contribution to this one, too. In January 1905, 5 months before the Great Prune Bear ever saw the light of day at the Lewis and Clark Exposition, Alma A. Rogers wrote an article for Portland Sunset magazine called Oregon's Prune Product.
The prunes begin to ripen the latter part of September. They are allowed to remain on the trees until fully matured, when they drop to the ground.
This, again, is Janet Fisher, as we walked around the dryer.
The picker arm comes out, grabs a tree, shakes it, and they come down on those tarps and then go into this conveyor belt.
Next, they are dipped into a hot water bath to cleanse and soften the skin.
Put them in here and dump them into a bath to wash them off.
Then spread upon trays and placed in ovens.
We'll These are old oil burners.
Mm-hmm.
And so you bring the oil in, the burner fires up a furnace in here. There are bricks in there that heat. And then air is blown over that. So the hot air blows across the prunes that are sitting on racks or trays in the dryer tunnels.
Janet Fisher showed me the massive latched doors to the tunnel dryer and explained to me how three individuals, known as dryer men, would work in three separate shifts, 24 hours a day during the harvest season, to take full advantage of the crop.
I will say there's nothing pleasanter than to come out here in the evening when there's a dryer, when the dryer's running, to lean on this door when it's hot, and you smell those prunes.
Yeah, I bet.
It's the most wonderful smell.
At the end of 12 to 24 hours, the prunes are ready to be turned into bins, where they remain 2 or 3 weeks to sweat.
If there has been any.
A major breakdown?
Yeah, you know, just over the years, as far as like the need for upkeep and certain things.
Oh, it's constant.
Yeah.
Yeah, the guy who is kind of our manager in the thing called us a working antique.
To give an idea of how dramatic the Oregon prunes rise was on a global scale, consider this. In 1898, Oregon exported 5 million pounds of prunes, and by just 1912, it had risen to 74,300,000 pounds. In the words of H.S. Gile, the secretary of the Willamette Valley Prune Association,
"The production of Pacific Coast prunes has entirely changed the prune trade in the world. Where formerly there was a large import of cheap Turkish prunes, the Oregon prunes today find their way into almost every European market."
How to make your own prune bear. Amy Scott is certified by the state of Washington as a master preserver, which has a hotline where she answers people's questions about canning, drying, and food safety. She is also a cook and a food display artist for a market in Portland, Oregon, so she is uniquely well qualified to help me make my miniature giant prune bear.
Yeah, okay. What are you thinking with the prunes?
We stood around in the living room and talked as we stuck prunes onto the bear's body that I had carved out of styrofoam.
Made out of...
I think it all is just part of the weirdness of the World's Fair. Like, it was just kind of the fad that was going on while the World's Fair were happening at the same time.
But I think it would be just as popular now.
I bet you
just as many people would stop and look.
They would, but they would
at,
probably...
an elephant made out of walnuts.
I bet people would raise a fuss about people starving in the street while prunes are being wasted.
Maybe, but I've never heard anybody say that about a chocolate fountain.
True.
Janet Fisher told me that the two major expenditures in the production of prune drying are labor and oil. She also told me that she had never had a problem finding labor. Pickers would come up for the harvest seasonally and lodge in what were known as prune shacks near the orchard every year. Oil, however, was less dependable. As soon as there was a prune drying industry in Oregon, there was a prune dryer insurance industry as well. It's not difficult to see how turning a wooden barn into a makeshift oven could result in a few accidental fires. Sifting through the historic newspapers, I found that there was a rate of about 2 prune dryer fires every year from 1909 to 1919, when something happened that made the issue of fire a not-so-accidental circumstance. It was called the West Coast Gas Famine of 1920. In Oregon, it was reported that motorists waited in line for hours at a time for just 2 gallons of their gasoline rations. In Seattle, there were accounts of police arresting drivers who left their cars idling. At this point in Western America, however, the gas famine didn't really affect the general public, who were still living in a largely pre-motorized era. But the one subsection of people who were utterly tied to oil's apron strings were the Oregon prune dryers. And their solution happened to be that insurance that I brought up earlier. By 1924, 6 dryers went up in flames within a single year, 2 of them even on a single night. I found this excerpt of an oral history by Forrest Kamick, who was a Salem-area dryer man, recorded by the Marion County Historical Society in 1982.
"Many a night we could look out our dryer and see a red glow in the sky. There goes another dryer."
I spoke with Janet Fisher about the uphill battle that her father's prune drying business had become.
We had, I think, about 5 or 6 growers when I started, and that's tapered down to two or three of us. So. Mm.
Why is that?
Well, the second year I did it, the price of oil shot up.
Mm.
I had to charge more. And then without some economy of scale, it just gets more expensive.
Mm.
And so last year we had very few prunes because the trees didn't bear well.
Mm-hmm.
And we just didn't run the dryer.
Yeah.
It was not economically feasible to do that.
So, but this is most likely, you're most likely not going to continue doing prunes then?
I think we'll probably phase it out over the long run.
Uh-huh. Yeah, phase it into filberts. Yeah.
Coincidentally, I found these words written in the October 1930 issue of Oregon Magazine as a sort of eulogy for the Oregon prune industry.
Now prunes are not worth the price of drying, but they will come back and be a profitable and respected crop in this Willamette Valley. When all the prune orchards have been turned into nut groves with rows of filberts bordered with daffodils and goldenrod, then prunes will be due for an encore. And not until then.
Like Janet Fisher, many have converted their prune orchards into fields of the ever-popular Oregon filbert, or hazelnut. Many of the old drying facilities now serve as dry storage for apples and nuts, or simply as a shelter for trucks and weathered farm equipment. The Oregon prune is now known again by its previous name, the Italian prune. Change is abundant, too, on the old grounds of the Lewis and Clark Exposition. In 1910, Giles Lake was filled with silt after an illegal building project attempted to carve out a street using high-pressure water hoses. The land took a great deal of time to settle, holding only a swath of industrial warehouses and temporary housing for shipyard workers for the next 20 or so years. All of the buildings from the Lewis and Clark Exposition were either demolished or crumbled away with time, save for one old bank that has been renovated and turned into a pub. There are no remaining statues, no old foundations, and no markers on the grounds, which is why I thought I would return to that last stop on the walking tour we took earlier and give a weird-looking 2-foot-tall bear covered in prunes a nice wooded home in Montgomery Park, to commemorate what historian Carl Abbott described as a community enterprise in an age of confidence. Confidence in industry, agriculture, and oil. Confidence via a 9-foot-tall bear covered in 20,000 prunes with mechanical eyes that go left to right and a phonograph in its mouth that goes... Thank you to Scott Daniels of the Oregon Historical Society and William Berg of the Sacramento Historical Society. Thank you so much to Janet Fisher and Amy Scott. Thank you to Sarah Hamlin, who played the part of Alma A. Rogers. Again, thank you to Mary B. Hansen of the Portland City Archives and Kylie Pine of the Willamette Heritage Foundation. Thank you to Kathleen Stevenson at KBOO Radio. Please visit 100TACKS on the web for pictures of Eugene Fisher's hand-built custom prune traying machine, a video of Amy Scott and myself constructing the prune bear, and yes, pictures of the true original. Music was created by Piano Tape. My name is Andrew Weymouth, and you've been listening to 100 Tacks.
I have eyes for you to give you dirty looks. I have words that do not come from children's books. There's a trick with a knife that I'm learning to do. Everything I've got belongs to you.
Three local women have taken a stand to protect an old-growth sequoia tree in Pier Park in St. John's. They are calling for people to come to Pier Park today to help support this action. The city says that cutting this 100-year-old sequoia tree is necessary to complete the North Portland Greenway Trail. The 10.4-mile multi-use trail will connect the East Bank Esplanade at the Steel Bridge to Kelly Point Park in North Portland. The trail route will include a bridge over railroad tracks to connect Pier Park and Chimney Park in St. John's. Portland Parks and Recreation says removing the tree is the plan with the least impact. Other plans would have involved removing a cluster of trees. The city says they will plant roughly 30 new trees in Chimney Park in place of the giant sequoia to be cut down. They plan to repurpose the downed tree as logs and benches in a nature play area at Westmoreland Park.
Joining us. Oops. Now.
Oops. Hang on.
Joining us now from the scene is Kendall, one of the protesters. There are three women there so far stopping the tree from being cut down this morning. Kendall, can you tell us the situation at Pier Park right now?
Yeah, right now they're pretty much keeping us under the dark, or in the dark. They're currently loading their chainsaws with gasoline, and just a second ago they told us they were going home. So obviously they're not going home. They're planning on cutting this tree anyway, and we're getting threatened to be arrested by the Parks and Recreation shareholders who are currently here along with the park rangers. I guess currently right now the city has called a meeting to talk about this tree and the situation right now. Right now they're telling us to leave and threatening to arrest us. Right at this moment, it's happening.
And are you asking for people to come to Pier Park to support this action to save the tree?
Yes, we need as many people as possible here protecting the tree. The more people here, I think they will not cut down the tree if there's a good amount of people here. And
Pier Park, for people who are listening, is in St. John's on the number 4 bus line off of Fessenden Street. And can you talk about why you decided to take a stand for this tree?
Well, I think it's totally doable in terms of saving this tree. If enough people are here every single day for the rest of the week, they won't be able to cut this tree down because of the Migratory Bird Act that is nationwide. As you hear, the chainsaw right now is on, and we're just all standing around the tree. So please, please come before it gets cut